Hey, everybody, I'm Rick Sanchez. I'm so glad that you're there. You know, usually around this time, what we do is we present the day's news and a nice little introduction, but we're going to be doing something a little different today. I want to thank you guys for being there. You know, we're reaching like 10 to 20 million people a week now from all over the world who are checking in to have this conversation that we have every day. And it's really important for us to be able to do that. Today, though, what we want to do is we want to introduce somebody who is, well, let's just say a special guest. And frankly, back in 2004, I was working at CNN. I had just been hired. And this gentleman had a show on CNN as well, and it was called Crossfire. And he was on the air with Paul Begala. And they did a political show, and CNN had hired me because they wanted me to go on the air right away because it was this giant hurricane, which was about to hit parts of Florida. I had a record for covering hurricanes, so they said, get on the air. We need you on the air right away. I wasn't even supposed to start yet. So they threw me on the air, and lo and behold, the very first show that I did when I was on CNN was on Crossfire with Paul Begala and Tucker Carlson. Tucker Carlson at the time was working there. I ended up working with him at CNN. I then worked with him as well at Fox News. So over the years, we've had kind of parallel paths in the media, which is significant because being in the media at CNN, as you know, for me, ended up not so well. In many ways, Fox was kind of the same way. It almost becomes, to a certain extent, like working at what they call state media. You get a sense that the message that they want you to share is not exactly the message that you want to share. And when you go outside of that message, you oftentimes are castigated for it. I was castigated for it, as many of you know. And so was Tucker when he was fired from Fox News. But since he's been fired from Fox News, he started doing something in the alternative media space. He's now become, very likely, the most watched alternative media news personality in the entire world. He had good numbers when he was at Fox News, but his numbers now far exceed whatever he was doing when he was at Fox News. So this is really what makes the difference for him. And since he's been doing this, he's not just been a purveyor of information, which is what oftentimes we describe ourselves as what we do. He's gone further. What he's actually doing now is creating something which is almost a movement in the United States. Let me show you this picture. It's a picture of Tucker in his home with some of the people who have joined him. And these are the mavericks. These are the people in the United States who are saying, we've got to come up with something where things change. It's not about any one president or any one party. It's about the fact that too much of the messaging in the United States has nothing to do with what's good for the people of the United States. You know, and there you see Marjorie Taylor Greene, and there you see Thomas Massey, and there you see Joe Kent with Tucker hosting them and their wives as well. And what seems to be happening in the United States for the first time in my lifetime is the general message is we've got to come up with something new, something that allows us to take care of the people of the United States, which is more important than the politicians, more important than the donors, more important than special interests. And this is really the general message that Tucker Carlson has been sharing. And by the way, sure, these are messages that you hear from time to time from people in the political world and people in the media, but more often than not, it turns out to be nothing more than sloganeering. I get a sense from my conversations with Tucker, from the texts that we share from time to time, from the interview he has done with me, from the conversations that we have done in the past, that Tucker is doing this because he truly believes it, because it's in his heart of hearts, because it's not because he wants to enrich himself, it's not because he needs more fame. He has all of those things. It's because he truly believes that we need to turn the page as a country, as Americans, and start doing things that are good for the American people, right? And this is one of the most important messages that can be shared now. And he is consistently carrying that message night in and night out on his show. Let me show you something. This is a conversation I had recently, because I think what this goes to is the kind of respect that Tucker has gotten, certainly from me as a result of our friendship and working together as colleagues and as journalists, but from other people as well. Here's an interview that I recently did with Candace Owens. Candace came here to Moscow. We sat down and I asked her a question. Listen to her response. Take a listen. You may have heard this, you may not have heard this, but there's a buzz out there in America that you would make a great next president of the United States. I apologize for asking, but...
No, you're fine. I really don't have an interest in running for office because there is just too much inauthenticity. Also, the great letdown of Trump. I would be interested in strongly getting behind someone like Tucker Carlson, though. I would. And so I would love for him to run, and I would create the dynamic that me and Charlie had and run all over to help him get elected because he...
And Tucker was also very fond and friendly with Charlie Kirk.
He was.
Both of you
and
were.
To see him be one of the lone voices, I would also say Megyn Kelly, who told the truth about Charlie's shifting perspectives toward the end.
Yes.
Just only further committed me to the... And he's also had a great place in his life. His children are older. I would gratefully get behind someone like Tucker Carlson.
See, I found that fascinating. Joining us now is none other than Tucker Carlson. Tucker, thanks so much for joining us. My God, you're so nice to spend time with us. You're such a good friend. And by the way, I am so happy. I was just sharing with our audience what kind of success you've had since you left Fox News or were left by Fox News.
Yes, I was. Yeah.
And I'm just so happy. Congratulations on your success. You've done great.
There's, I know you know, being fired is one of the great blessings very often. You know, I would have stayed there forever, but so thank God they fired me.
I just showed Candace Owens. She was here and I had a conversation with her and I said, you know, Candace, there's a lot of people who are talking about the fact that you would be a great leader because you're so courageous. And would you consider running for president? And she said, no, but I would consider being with or backing Tucker Carlson if he ran for president. I don't know if you heard her say that, but what do you make of
not
some...
until right now?
Really? She said that. Yeah. She said that about you. She said she wants you to be president. And if you run for president, she'll join you in any way that you need her. That's something.
Well, I mean, it's really a reflection on the poverty of our politics, how bad our political class is. I mean, I'm a podcaster. I've never been elected to anything. I've never really run anything. So if we're in a place where people are sincerely saying someone like me should take charge, that tells you a lot about the people who are in charge.
Yeah.
They're totally unworthy of the offices they hold. And that's so clearly true. And you know that because they're running the United States into the ground, both domestically and internationally. Our empire is collapsing. We're on the brink of a third world war, and our country is getting poor. So anyone responsible for that is by definition, well, in my view, a criminal, but at minimum incompetent and just not qualified to do what he's doing.
I just showed a picture of you with Joe Catt and Thomas Massie and Marjorie Taylor Greene in your home. Great, great picture, by the way. Everybody looks happy and it looks like you're having a conversation over a meal, which is, you know, a pretty cool thing. What's the meaning behind this? Is Candace on to something here? Or are you thinking about creating something?
Well, I'm not planning to run for president, that's for sure. But those are people, Marjorie, Joe, Thomas Massie. I mean, those are three people who I think understand the moment we're in. And the moment we're in is pretty simple. I think a lot of Americans have realized that the Democratic and the Republican Party agree with each other on the biggest issues, that is the economy and foreign policy, and highlight their minor differences in order to hide that fact from the rest of us. And moreover, that actually the big decisions of the U.S. government are not made by elected officials. They're made by the permanent bureaucracy, the deep state. That's a fact. I've watched it. So that's not democracy. That's not. And by the way, they're not doing a good job. You know, it'd be one thing if you had a non-democratic system. There are plenty of them in the world. There are lots of monarchies that are run pretty well.
Yeah.
You would say, well, OK, it's not a democracy, but at least it works. We have the worst of all systems. It's not a democracy and it doesn't work. And so clearly we need an alternative, and I have no idea what that will be, but there will be an alternative because this is not acceptable.
I've almost gotten to the, I don't know about you, but You know, one of the things that we've always prided ourselves on as Americans is that we got to elect a new person every 4 years. So the American people yes. voted and chose somebody, and that person went in there. We say, now it's going to get better. But it never gets better, which makes me wonder if, is it really a democracy if no matter who you put in there, they do the same damn thing that the guy before them did? Isn't that really more a description of like a totalitarian system, maybe even a dictatorship? Just because you change the person doesn't mean you change the system.
Well, I think it's even worse than that because it's a fraud. At least if you had a strongman, which I don't want at all. I'm an American. I believe in the sovereignty of the individual. But if you had that, at least you would know what you had. You wouldn't be under illusions that you had choice. And I would say it's not just that the United States has declined. It's declined in exactly the same way that Europe, Canada, Australia, and New Zealand have declined. In exactly the same way. The same demographic collapse, birth rate collapse, the same sort of official state atheism, the same mass migration, the same concentration of wealth in a tiny number of hands. Like, it's a recognizable pattern. It's not just the United States, it's the West, and particularly the English-speaking West, has been destroyed. And I don't think it's an accident. I don't think it's organic at all. I mean, clearly it's not. It's happening in all these different countries since the end of the Second World War. The supposed victors of the war have all been destroyed in exactly the same way. What is that? Now, I'm not sure I understand the answer fully, but I'm pretty good at pattern recognition, and I'm telling you, it's of a piece. And it's totally wrong, and it's resulted in the suffering and death of a lot of people. And so to the extent I can have any control, clearly I have no control over anything. I couldn't stop the Iran war, but I'm still going to keep trying because I think this is so immoral.
Moral. There you go again. You use that word a lot. You know...
Yes.
I think you're onto something. I mean... You know what our defense budget was in like the 1950s? It was about $13, $14 billion. Today, it's almost $2 trillion. And our defense was better back then than it is today because back then it was based on a need. It was existential. It was moral. It was about we have to come together to defend our country. I don't think that's what it's about today.
Well, it's no longer the Defense Department. It's the Department of War. And so that... change in name tells you everything about the change in orientation. What's the point of a standing army, or the point of a military, the point of spending the majority of your discretionary budget on the military? It's to defend yourself, your nation, to keep your country from being invaded. Oh, too late. We already were invaded by migrants, over 50 million of them in the past 5 years.
Yeah.
So no, there was no effort to defend the United States against an actual invasion. Defense is not the point of our military. Now it's war. Well, by the way, civilized people detest war because it results in the deaths of innocents. And so why would you want a Department of War? No, you want a department to defend your people, your women and your children, to be a lot more precise about it. Your women and your children. Defending them is the point of a military. That's the only point. And that's, of course, no longer the point of ours. And so that right there tells you, you know, we're leaving the land of legitimate and entering the world of the criminal.
And so much of this is about the war, though. You just talked about immigration. Part of the reason we have immigration in the United States is because of needless, stupid wars where we go and we disrupt the lives of people who live in other countries who then feel like they have no choice but to leave their countries. A perfect example of that is Guatemala back in the 1950s with our bands. We take a guy out who's democratically elected because we want to give some kind of power to some American oligarchs. And then we start a civil war where some 100,000 people die, and then all the people leave and come to the United States, and now we're mad that they came to the United States. So what the hell do we expect them to do, right?
It's a very well-observed and understood phenomenon. Invade the world, import the world. And it's been going on for many, many decades in the United States. And so at this point, it's not an accident. So if you... If the very people in this administration who are in charge of protecting our border are pushing a war in, say, Latin America, invading Venezuela for some reason and arresting its president for some reason, totally insane, or what they're doing in Cuba right now, or what they just did in Iran in February, those people know that the result of all of those conflicts is going to be mass migration into the United States and Europe. So it's not like they can claim ignorance. They know what the effects are. So you have to sort of wonder, maybe that is the point. And then you watch what just happened in Spain. where Spain gets sideways with the government of Israel, and all of a sudden it gets invaded from North Africa, and the Israelis are like, yeah, we did that. Oh, so maybe mass migration is used as a weapon. Well, of course it is. It always has been. It has been since the Mongols swept across the steppe into Russia. It has always been. The Bible describes it repeatedly throughout the Old Testament. Mass migration, the replacement of one population by another, is a tool of war. It's an act of war. And that's happening now. And it's happening to the United States and to the West without kind of our understanding of what's happening. Like, oh, this just happens. Maybe they're responding to a labor shortage. I don't think so. This is an effort to end these countries, these historic nations. And they want to do it to Russia. They hate Russia. Well, why do they hate Russia so much? Well, I think it's very much related to the fundamentals of Russia. Maybe being the last big white Christian country on the planet is a dangerous thing to be. I mean, I don't want to believe these things. I never did believe them. But watching carefully for a long time has convinced me that a lot of the wacko fringes' darkest suspicions may have some truth in them. Because what's the other answer? Why would we be at war with Russia? How many Americans want a war with Russia? That was not on our list of options in the last election. Vote for this guy. We'll get a war with Russia. Nobody wants this, but our leaders want it. And you have to ask why.
Ever since I talked to you about Biden for some reason, or the people who work with Biden forcing me to not be able to practice my craft in America, I have come and spent some time in Russia and in other places, but I've gotten to know the Russian people. And I'll share something with you because, you know, we're friends and I can tell you this. I thought when I got here, people would say, you're an American and we can't stand you for what you're doing to us and for attacking us and for whatever else they may perceive that we were doing, which may have been an injustice. It's just the opposite. They love America. They love our they love our culture. When you walk into a, you were here. When you walk into a mall in Russia, you see American names, American slogans, American ideas. You hear American songs that they're playing in the background. And yet, it seems funny because they've never asked us for anything. We don't send money to Russia, but we send it to all these other countries. It almost seems peculiar that we would treat people who are not meaning any harm to us that way. I don't get it. How would you explain that?
Well, I would just correct you on one point. I agree with everything you said, except when you said they don't ask us for anything. They did ask. President Putin asked to join NATO in 2000. He asked President George W. Bush to join NATO, the defensive alliance designed to keep Russia under control. Russia asked to join it, at which point you say to yourself, okay, we're done here. We've succeeded. The people we thought were enemies are now our friends. Like, why wouldn't you want Russia in NATO? That's like the number one thing you would want. That's the whole point of NATO, is to get Russia to behave like the West. Well, okay, now they're asking to be part of it. And we turned them down. George W. Bush turned them down apparently under the spell of Condoleezza Rice, his national security advisor. Yeah. And it's like, at that point, that's the most revealing fact of the last 30 years, in my opinion. We want a war with Russia, and the people pushing this believe that somehow they own Russia, maybe because their ancestors lived there or something. I don't understand the psychology, but they think they have a right to control what happens in Russia, how it's governed, and they would like to break up Russia. And they clearly would like the resources of Russia. I mean, they've said this. Yeah. So if you're Russian, if the Russian perspective is this is not a joke, it's not about some oblasts in eastern Ukraine, it's about your survival as a nation. So I guess what I'm saying is, as an American, I am very concerned that we are pushing Russia toward a third world war. And I think that we are. And I think it's a lot closer than most Americans understand. No one's paying any attention at all in the United States, just so you know, in case you haven't been here recently. They're thinking about their lives. They're thinking about, to the extent they think about the rest of the world, they're thinking about Iran. They are not thinking about what's happening in Eastern Europe. And my view, as someone who's talking to a bunch of people, is that we are closer than we've ever been to a global conflict over this war with Russia. And the reason is really simple. The United States is waging a war against Russia. Most Americans don't know that. And if that continues, I'm very concerned that this could get completely out of control and kill a lot of people and destroy the United States. So I'm not for that. Why would I be for that? I'm not.
Russia's very imperfect, just like you are and I am and every country in the world is in many ways, of course, right? But generally speaking, the things that I have always been taught were very American from the standpoint of our culture and, as you say, our morals. I find here. They're building more churches here than we're building in the United States. They are relying more on their Christian faith more than I've seen in most places. Suzanne and I this weekend went up to Uglich, and we saw the sense of community built around the church and what the priests there were talking about. And I was saying, wow, this is something that we don't see so much in the United States. Russians, I find, are looking for ways to improve their lives. They're looking to build businesses. They're encouraged to build families. And the more they build their families, the more the government gives them. There's a health care plan. They get maternity leave. They get overtime pay required by, you know, the government. We don't have these things in the United States. So,
yeah,
those things are important, aren't they?
Well, of course they are. And the Russian government is also, I should just add, banned witchcraft and GMO. So also support that. But it's not even a question. And I agree strongly with what you're saying. I think Russia is a beautiful country. It's an amazing country. My favorite country I've ever visited. I've been a couple of times. I hope to come more.
Yeah.
But that's not why I'm so agitated or why my voice is rising or why I suddenly feel so emotional. What makes me emotional is how pointless this is. There is no critical American interest that is served by having a war with Russia. Right. And in fact, all of our critical interests are threatened by that. It is deranged. We did not need to do this. Most Americans don't want this. They definitely don't want to live with the consequences of continuing to do it, which are profound. And the only reason we're doing this is because our leadership class, which is illegitimate and demonstrably terrible at their jobs, wants it for whatever sick, weird reason. And, you know, who knows what those reasons are. But they are totally determined to do this against the will of the American people and against the interests of America. And so it just, it drives me crazy because this does not need to happen at all.
This is the thing I've always gotten from you. And one of the reasons I've really come to, and I don't mean to sound schlocky or anything, but I've really come to respect you as a colleague and as a friend is your message is always consistent. And it's this. We need to get back to taking care of the interests of the American people, because with each passing year, we're getting away from that. That's what I hear you say over and over again. And we see it in Iran. We see it in our relationship with Israel. We see it with what's going on in Ukraine and in other places as well. How do we get there? And why did we lose that perspective?
Well, because I think, and I didn't used to think this, but I have been led to this conclusion by the things that I have seen up close, not just read about, but watched personally. I think that the United States government, which is the largest human institution in history, has more people and more funding than any human institution ever, has been completely hijacked by people who are using the United States for their own purposes, who have no real interest in the United States and its future, who aren't tied to its past, and who are basically just wearing it as a skin suit in order to, who knows what, lots of things, but none of them in the interest of the United States. I really think it's a very simple question of a bad leadership class. Like, we don't have good leaders. And we know this from living in families. When you have a strong father who loves his children, in general, you have a thriving family. I mean, things can happen, of course.
Yeah.
But most of the time, the love of a strong father is enough to create a happy, thriving family. And that is true with countries as well. And we don't have that. And I wish we did. I pray that we will, but we don't. And that is really kind of the whole story right there.
Well, that's because it seems to me that every 4 years, half of the country decides that one party is good and the other guy's bad. Like right now, it's going to be it's going to be Trump is bad. Before it was Biden is bad, Obama. But you're not getting anything different no matter who ends up in office. So maybe there's something wrong with the process, right?
Well, I agree with that. And you're encouraged, and this is poisonous, and I've played a big role in it over the years, and I'm ashamed,
Me too.
But
me
you're
too.
Encouraged to hate your fellow Americans.
Yeah.
And you're encouraged. I mean, someone said to me the other day, like, what are you talking about a third party? You're going to get AOC elected. And I'm like, I don't want Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. She's clearly unqualified and silly. And like, I'm not for her, of course. And she doesn't like whites. And I'm, you know, obviously against that. But you're what you're trying to do here is what you always try and do. And what I have played a role in doing, which is convincing people that my side might not be great, but the other side is evil. And that's just a lie. The truth is, it's not the differences between us that are the problem. It's the consensus at the top. It's the collusion against the American people by the leadership of both parties, against the interests of the majority of both parties. That is the true crime here. And you'll notice, by the way, Trump leads us into this war in Iran. The public doesn't want it at all.
Of course not.
And guess who doesn't protest it? The leadership of the Democratic Party. Why? Because they're for it too. So that just kind of tells you everything. That, for me, was the most radicalizing thing I've seen in 35 years of covering American politics. Chuck Schumer was not mad about the war, the regime change war with Iran, because he's in favor of it.
Yeah.
He and the Republican leadership are on the same page on the biggest question of my lifetime. Right.
So they'll criticize Trump about trans issues, but they won't criticize him about this.
Exactly. Exactly. That's exact. No, that is literally true. Yeah, let's fight about transgenderism. Well, obviously, transgenderism is sad and absurd and an offense against nature and a middle finger to Christianity and God. I get all that.
Yeah, but
I believe that. I'll always know that that's true. Is that the pivotal question in America on the planet? No, of course not. It's a sideshow created to distract you from what's actually happening, which is a total takeover of the United States by people who don't care about the United States.
I was kind of forced into this position to be a kind of journalist that travels the world and goes to China and goes. You and I have talked about this. And in many ways, yes, I've grown and I've gotten to better understand the world, which is what I think we owe ourselves and our families and our communities and our God to learn, to make ourselves wiser as we get older. And man, I'm getting older. One of the things that I see is that the world now looks at us in ways where we weren't looked at before. And I see this development of these BRICS countries. I talk to people in India, and I talk to people in the Middle East, and I talk to people in China and in Russia. And it's almost like they're coming together and forcing some kind of coalition, not based on what they want to do because they don't like the United States, but it's based almost, they tell me, on the fact that the United States is forcing them to do that.
Of course.
Americans don't get that, and most politicians don't get that. But we're going to need to understand that at some point. The power of the Global South, the power of these countries, the numbers that they have, the GDPs that they have, those things are important. Why don't we get it?
Because we're imprisoned by our own ignorance, and I have been. I grew up in a family where my dad worked abroad for the U.S. government. So I felt like, and we traveled a lot. So I felt like I had a more global perspective, but I really didn't.
Yeah.
And it was only when I began traveling for weeks or months at a time and really spending time in countries and talking to people in those countries that I understood my own country better. And it increased my love for my country. I love America more. Yes. I don't have another passport. I'm not going anywhere until they expel me, I guess. But I would never leave the United States. I really love the United States, but I see it in context. And I understand that what we're looking at is a conflict between countries that believe in the future, that have a hope for the future, and the West, which has really lost all confidence in the future and doesn't think about it. Look, anyone who is risking nuclear, I'm trying not to use bad words on your show, nuclear war, clearly doesn't care about the future. That is nihilism. That is a belief in nothing. Nothing matters. Nothing is real. There is no God. All that matters is right now. That is the attitude that has seized our leadership class. And you know that because they're literally flirting with nuclear. I've interviewed Russians on this show, my show.
Yeah.
And they'll come on and say, boy, you know, we're going to start lobbing hypersonic or nuclear weapons into NATO countries if you don't pull back a little bit. Now, you would think that would be, you could say, well, oh, Russia's bad. Fine. But it doesn't matter. That's a real threat. And it makes sense, of course. I understand why that threat is there. If you don't respond to that, if you just ignore it and say, oh, they don't mean it, then you don't care about the future or your children or the prospect of having grandchildren or your nation continuing. And that's the mindset that they have. And I think it's scary. Whereas a lot of the countries you mentioned are literally, we call them developing countries for a reason, because they're developing. They are building something brand new and they care about what the next 50 or 100 years look like. That to me is the main contrast, and it's very sad as an American to see that.
There was an incident here recently that kind of, I don't know, it made me feel bad because I'm a dad and I hate to see children die. And there was like a missile attack or a drone attack on a beach in Russia where families were gathered and they were just having a holiday. I don't know if we've got this video or not. If we have it, you can show it, guys. If not, no big deal. But you could actually see the drone go and hit a beach where children are building like sandcastles. There it is, Tucker. I don't know if you've seen this. This just happened last week. And four kids, like building sandcastles with their families, were killed. Eight people were killed in total. The number may be higher now. But that it just doesn't seem like it makes sense that the these drones manufactured by American companies, by the way, and by British companies, and by French companies, and by German companies, are constantly hitting civilians in Russia. And this is not about whether you're for Ukraine or Russia or whoever you choose to like in this war. The idea that you can take a drone on a beach and kill families and children playing and building sandcastles, that's immoral. It's wrong. It shouldn't happen. And we should know about it. And we should ask it for people to stop it as Americans.
I couldn't agree more. And by the way, those were targeted by the U.S. government. I mean, CIA gives the targeting information to all this stuff. And so this is an American war against Russia. And again, even if you hate Russia, you can acknowledge that's crazy behavior, because what do you think you're going to get if it continues? And if I can just level one criticism at the Russian government.
Yeah, of course.
It's that this has been going on for a long time. There have been drone attacks on mainland Russia, including in Moscow, for a long time, and assassinations in Moscow as well. And in fact, I was there 2.5 years ago, and all of a sudden I'm driving by the Kremlin and it's on fire. And I asked, like, what is that? And they're like, oh, it's nothing. So the Russian government has not wanted to acknowledge attacks within Russia by the Ukrainians and NATO. And I understand the thinking there, but I think the effect of that has been that people have no idea it's even happening. And they also, moreover, don't know that Ukraine has been taken over not by Nazis. I know everyone uses that. They're all Nazis. They're Bolsheviks, actually. This is very much like the Bolshevik takeover of Russia in 1917 by people who were mostly not Russian and who had no interest in Russia as a coherent country. And that has happened in Ukraine. And all the familiar repression has followed. Elimination of freedom of speech, freedom of movement, freedom of religion, banning the biggest church in Ukraine. It is a Bolshevik state. And we don't say that out loud. We pretend that they're freedom fighters or whatever. No. That country has descended into darkness, into totalitarian darkness. And we are funding it. And we are allowing this to happen. Meanwhile, the actual nation of Ukraine, Ukrainian people, have been totally destroyed. There is no Ukraine anymore because they have been pulverized in the meat grinder of this war that we're directing. So the whole thing is like one of the great tragedies of our age. But I just want to say it for the third time. We are moving toward a global conflict that will destroy millions of people. And so anyone pushing that is by definition immoral, obviously.
There's pictures. There's another set of videos that have been coming out as well. And I don't know how you feel about this. It's really weird. It's almost like the idea that somebody would go into a community and start taking people off the streets, and you see their wives and their children coming out and say, you know, don't take my husband, don't take my dad. But these are the pictures. This is called forced mobilization, and it's taking place in Ukraine. And look, I get it. They're running out of soldiers, and they need to do everything they do. And maybe some of these people should have volunteered and have been hiding or something, but this just looks terrible for the rest of the world that Ukraine has to resort to fighting with people in communities, taking them off the streets and sending them to the front lines. What do you make of this?
Well, I mean, it kind of undercuts the whole argument that you hear in the United States that Ukraine is defending itself and the proud Ukrainian people want to repel Russian aggression.
Yeah.
I'm not saying the Ukrainians are pro-Russian. I doubt most are. But if the Ukrainian people don't support this war, it is by definition illegitimate. Ukraine has no sovereignty. It hasn't since at least 2014, and it probably never had sovereignty, actually, depending how you define it. But the truth is, Ukraine is not a nation. It is a client state of NATO and the United States, our leadership, and it is being used as a tool to achieve an end, and that end is the destruction of Russia. Now, again, as noted, why would we want to do that? I have no idea. I think it's bizarre and wrong, but that's what it is. It's not a sovereign country fighting for its freedom. It is a poor, pathetic, sad, destroyed country that we destroyed.
Yes.
By the way, we're only here in the first place because the Biden administration and previous administrations, including Bush, all pushed Ukraine to join NATO and therefore put nuclear weapons on Russia's border. Like, why would you ever want to do something like that? Well, only if you wanted a war would you do that. Only if you wanted Russia to respond with violence, which they did, would you do that. Now, why would you want Russia to respond that way? So you could have a war with Russia and break up Russia because you hate the idea of Russia. Again, nobody supports this. I think the majority of Ukrainians in polls say they want an end, a negotiated end to this war. Americans don't support this. The only people who support this are the deranged leaders of the West. That's it.
Yeah, and by the way, Russians, I talk to them, obviously. I play golf on weekends, and some of my friends that I play golf with, by the way, they get angry at Putin. They think that, you know, he's not doing enough. They want him to respond in kind to some of the threats. And they're like saying, well, you know, he needs to do this. And you hear it. So there's constant conversation taking place. The other thing I hear on the golf course and in other places when I talk to drivers and people around Moscow is they don't have anything against the Ukrainian people. You don't hear this vile sense of, oh, we're going to get those guys. Not at all. As a matter of fact, you get a sense that they feel like those are their brothers, those are their cousins, that they have a history with them. I mean, an earnest sense of camaraderie with Ukraine, a country they're at war with, which is weird, right?
Well, right. So everybody involved in this, the populations of Ukraine, Russia, and the United States are all pawns in someone else's game, obviously. Yeah. So why would you send a drone onto a beach in Russia? Why would you blow up its oil refineries? Why would you hit a school? What you're doing, of course, is trying to force Putin to react with violence, force Putin to escalate in a public way. So the United States and NATO are behind these attacks, as noted. Most people in the West have no idea they're even happening. So the point is to push Putin into a place where he cannot ignore this, where his population and the different power centers within Russia put so much pressure on Putin that he has to respond to the hypersonic missile into Warsaw or Hamburg, or has to hit a NATO country either with a hypersonic weapon or some kind of weapon, perhaps even a tactical nuclear weapon. And at that point, you can say, oh, Putin's the aggressor. That's exactly what's happening right now. And I've made this case to a lot of people, including a lot of policymakers in Washington. You have this caricature of Putin as an absolute dictator who can do whatever he wants, who has total latitude in his decisions. And that's not true of any leader. Every leader rules by consensus. I don't care if you're a king or a president or a prime minister. I don't care if you call yourself the Messiah, you are still operating within certain boundaries. And those boundaries are the opinions of other people with power in your country. And so if Russians over time get upset enough about these attacks, the government of Russia will have to respond, will have to escalate. And that is the whole point. Trust me.
Yeah, they're angry. My sense is that, yes, they're angry. They think Putin is too restrained. And then they're also angry at the people who they think are responsible for these bombs. And it's not Ukraine. They're angry at EU and NATO and Brussels and the UK. That's who they're angry at. They think it's Europe.
Is it really the EU and Nussels? But I know that Russians think that. And of course, they lost 27 million people or whatever in a war with some of these countries. So yeah. I understand that there's a lot of history here. However, do we really think that the EU or even NATO have sovereignty, that they're making independent decisions, that they're acting in their own interests? Obviously not. Do you think the population of Germany wants this, or even Britain? Britain is the most warlike of all, but do you really think they want this? Of course they don't. They are also pawns in whatever this is. And of course, it's a great global realignment of power. As the East rises and the West declines, there has to be, in the view of the people mapping this out, some confrontation that just resets the board, resets the international monetary system, the terms of trade. All of this stuff is going to be reset, and the only way to reset it is with a global war. That's very obvious to me. So I understand the frustration, but let's be clear-eyed here. Well, Europe has no ability to make independent decisions. It's got American troops on its soil, and it has for 80 years. You know what I mean?
It's about... if I can just throw out a name, Palantir. I mean, the guidance for that drone we just saw hitting and killing those children was done by Palantir. But Palantir is not a country. It's just some entity in the United States that seems to wield a lot of power. How do you deal with that? How does Russia, how does any country deal with these sudden powerful tech companies that are making these incredible decisions that are determining the future of our planet, essentially?
Well, I think you have to just understand the nature of power. So power follows capital. Like, what is power? It's the ability to effect change. It's the ability to get things done, to see your will enacted into some physical form, right?
Yeah.
So what gets things done? Money. So what are the global power centers? The global capital centers, of course. So if a country, you know, has a democratic system and elections and politicians and all that stuff, but that country has, you know, companies or individuals within it who are billion or trillionaires, who's really got the power? The voters? No, of course not. Capital has the power always. That is just a fact. And that's why it's a pretty good idea if you want to continue your democracy to make sure that elected officials are more powerful than companies. Otherwise, democracy is itself a joke.
That's why
and
you...
Putin, that, to his great credit, like tried to do that to some extent, I think.
Well, Putin did something that I almost wish our leaders would do as Americans. In the 1990s, he saw that these were there were these oligarchs, whatever that means, people who were very, 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 very wealthy. I mean, they had enormous amounts of wealth. They weren't paying taxes, and they were doing all kinds of malfeasance. And he went to them and said, either you pay taxes, you change your ways, or you get the hell out of here, or I'm going to put you in prison. One of the reasons, as I perceive it, and, you know, what do I know? But my perception is people in Russia have problems with Putin, sure, but they generally like him. They want him to stay in power. 80% say German polls, and it's because they feel like he has their interests, especially because of what he did in the 1990s when he did that.
Well, exactly. No, I think that's right. I mean, that will not happen in the United States, at least anytime soon. But you can't have it. Look, someone's going to run your country, your society, your civilization. Someone's always going to be in charge. And the question is, who is that person? Is that someone whose job you have some control over, like through an election? Or is it someone you have no control over whatsoever? Like, I don't know, the guy who runs Apple, right? Or Google. And so that's really your choice. Are you going to have any say in how your society is run, or aren't you? And if you are going to have say, then it has to be a political leader. Political leader has to be more powerful than any oligarch. And we don't have that. But I would say that's true globally in the West.
Yeah.
And the only two countries I can think of where there is, and I'm not endorsing either country, and I don't live in one, either one, I'm not going to, but Russia and China are two countries in which the political leader is more powerful than any business leader. So, I kind of wish we had that.
Yeah, I think you're right. I went to China recently, and at first, it's funny because when I got there, I thought everybody was going to be frightened and scared of their system, et cetera. And I remember I asked the driver right away, I said, what do you think of Xi, right? And he said, oh, he's a princeling. We don't like this guy. We want to change. And I thought, you know, it's no different than in any other country, everywhere else. And you go here and you'll go to a bar and you ask people about Putin. I go, I don't like him either. So, you know, we tend to think this is an amazing, autocratic country where people are punished just for their thoughts. They're not. We kind of make
up. Well, here's a way to measure it. How many people in Russia go to jail for criticizing the government or government policy on social media? And the numbers are public. And I was amazed to find out that three times as many people in Britain, which has a much smaller population than Russia, under 100 million, Russia's 150-ish, three times as many Britons go to jail for social media posts as Russians.
Yeah.
I'm not endorsing Russia, but I'm just saying, like, which is the more totalitarian country? Well, obviously it's Britain. By definition, it's Britain. Yeah. You can watch British television in Russia. You cannot watch Russian television in Britain.
That's right.
So which is a more repressive nation? It's really simple. These are obvious non-rhetorical, non-ideological measurements of reality. Who goes to jail? What access to information do you have, right?
I was just thinking about when you were talking about America's oligarchs, my words, not yours, these really, really wealthy, I guess, billionaires and trillionaires who, in many ways, it could be argued, have more power than the people who we elect. I would argue they have much more power than the people who we elect, but we'll leave that there. What's particularly unique to the American experience now is it's not just those people. It's those people who are now combined with an external force, and that external force, I think, is Israel. I think a lot of those people are not only doing things on behalf of their government and making more money, they're also doing it on behalf of another country that is not the United States of America. And it seems like an interlocking that can lead to no place but a bad place for Americans in general. I've heard you talk about this, but you brought it up last night. I was watching you with Hunter Biden, which fascinating interview. I texted you earlier about it. And when he mentioned the fact that his laptop was suddenly discovered, I mean, what an interesting guy, by the way. And he's finding his way. You said something to him which I thought was fascinating, which I've never heard before. And here it is. Let's play that.
The allegation that there was abusive minors proven on the laptop, that came from the Israelis. I'm just telling you that. They came to me with that. So I know that. And one of the things that enraged me about the statement from those sleazy intel guys is that they blame the Russians for it. Now, maybe the Russians had a hand in it, but it was the Israelis who were pushing that fact. Yeah. Fact. They, I mean, literally to me, they were pushing that so hard. And all the intel guys are like, oh, it's Russia. It's like, you lie. You lie. Because they called me. I sent one of my producers out to go meet with one of a guy connected to Netanyahu. They were behind that. And I felt that everybody in DC knew that, but there was so much pressure never to criticize Israel in any way that they were just like, it's the Russians. It's the Russians. They're the ones penetrating our political system. It's like, you lie.
What does that say that they would do that? President's son.
Well, it was an amazing, I mean, I'll be honest, that was what, 5 or 6 years ago, I guess.
Yeah.
I didn't fully understand. I mean, I never fully understand what's happening when it's happening. And often it takes me years to understand it if I ever do. So I only see bits and pieces of things, but I it's just a fact. And I worked at Fox News at the time and I had a lot of producers who still work for me. I mean, it just, this happened. People connected to Netanyahu came to us. And I didn't think of Netanyahu as like an enemy of mine or anything like that at the time, and said, we have this information from Hunter Biden's laptop, and it includes the abuse of minors or a minor, a specific minor. And anyway, so that just happened. And the next thing you know, all these disgusting former intel officers are out there saying it's Russian disinformation. Now, here's what I know. The laptop was not, you know, it didn't come from a laptop repair shop. It was in circulation before Hunter Biden even supposedly dropped it off. I mean, I've known this for 6 years. I knew that part of the story was fake. I don't think that John Paul McIsaac, the laptop repair shop guy who I've interviewed, a very nice man, I don't think he's in on it. I think he genuinely believes that Hunter Biden left his laptop there. I'm assuming that. But the truth is, someone pulled it off the cloud. Now, some people claim it was the Russian security services that did that. Maybe. I have no idea. All I know is that by the time it came to me, who was a working journalist, it was Israelis who came to us to say, here's this stuff about Hunter Biden. And what was their motive? Well, I don't think that Netanyahu wanted Joe Biden to win. I think it's really clear. He was a close ally of Donald Trump, and he didn't think it was in Israel's interest or his personal interest to have Biden as president. And so he was interfering in American politics, not the first or last time he's done that. But we put up with that because no one in America, in American politics, is ever allowed to criticize Israel in any way.
Yes.
Because they're controlled by Israel. Obviously, if you want to know who controls you, who can't you criticize? I mean, it's just a basic fact of life. So they are controlled by Israel. And I think have been for a long time. And I've kind of ignored it for many, many years because it was offensive, but it didn't seem like it was destroying the United States. But this Iran war is destroying the United States. And we got into this war because we were pushed by the Israelis, because they have such total control over our political process. It's a fact. They can lie or call you names or you're a Nazi. No, okay. I'm not a Nazi, but even if I were a Nazi, this is still true. It's a fact. I saw it and everybody knows it. So At this point, it's like there's a massive cost to this. It's hurting our nation gravely. And we have to break free from it, not because we hate Israel, or certainly not because we hate Jews. I don't hate Jews at all. And I don't hate Israel for that matter. But you have to have sovereignty, particularly as a great power, or else you will be destroyed.
You know,
and that's just always true.
The things you are doing and the things you are saying now, Tucker, are courageous. I mean, there's really no other word. I say the same thing. It's not just you, by the way. Candace Owens, I think Marjorie Taylor Greene, you know, certainly Thomas Massie is a super courageous guy. This guy's got somebody throwing money at him every day. He says, no, I don't want it. Right? I mean, that's
exactly
that's moral, you know, courage. That's all the things that my father and your father taught us to be as men in this world. And you know, it's funny that there are so many others out there who just fold. The numbers that I've seen recently seem to indicate that like 97% of the people in Congress immediately take whatever thing, whatever is offered to them by Israel and other donors, by the way. It's not just Israel. What a terrible place for us to be right now as a nation. That's terrible.
Well, it's not simply that most politicians are craven and greedy and care only about money and not at all about their constituents. That's bad enough.
Yeah.
But to see how Thomas Massie and Marjorie Taylor Greene were treated, you know, you've got a couple of honest, decent people. You may disagree with them,
but
clearly Massie and Marjorie are not in it for the money, obviously. They're not in it for the money.
Yeah.
They're in it because they believe it. They're sincere. They care about their constituents. They have principles. They're generally very honest people, in my experience. I don't think anyone could claim otherwise. They were systematically slandered and torn down, and in Massey's case, bounced out of Congress for telling the truth. So that, to me, is the real offense. It's not that some people are corrupt. It's that honest people are penalized or punished for being honest. And if that is your system, it has to change. A system like that is not a good system. It's an evil system. We should reward honesty and courage and decency because those are the values that are good and that we hope to embody and represent. We love our country because we think it's a good country. And so it has to remain a good country in order for us to love it and be proud of it.
Yeah.
It's that simple. We, you know, and nothing is perfect. And you acknowledge, as you said, Putin, not a perfect leader. Okay, well, who is?
Yeah.
But you've got to at least try to be honest and decent, and you definitely are not allowed to hurt people because they're being honest. That is like a grave offense, in my opinion.
Yeah, and it's like the deal with Israel in particular, and I think long and hard about this because it's affected my career, it affected your career as well. The idea that because of October 7th, they suddenly have a license to kill some 16,000 to 18,000 children. There's no way in the world that I or anybody else should ever accept that. And it doesn't mean that I hate Israel. It doesn't mean I hate Jews. It doesn't mean any of that. It just means, why the hell are you killing children? We cannot allow you to do that, and certainly not with our weapons. I mean, it's such a clear-headed message.
Well, it's a message rooted in universal standards. So if something is wrong, it's always wrong, no matter who does it. So this is the definition of corruption. What is corruption? Corruption is a second set of books. It's a second set of standards. It's okay for me to do it. It's not okay for you to do it. That's corruption.
Yeah.
The opposite of that, the Western ideal, the basis of Western civilization, is the idea that we are all governed by the same standards because we're all created by God. And those standards derive from God. And even if you don't believe in God, you can accept that universal standards are the standards by which we govern a country. That's called justice. Justice is blind because we're not judging you on the basis of who you are or who your parents were. We're judging you on the basis of what our rules are. What's the law? And Israel, like every nation on earth, like every person on earth, is governed by those same principles. It is immoral. It will always be immoral to kill people who did nothing wrong. That's why we don't just execute people because we feel like it. We have to bring them to court and prove they did something worthy of execution. And the same is true for wars. You don't intentionally kill civilians. And if you do, you're a criminal. So Israel is a criminal state. Okay. There have been a lot of criminal states in human history. I don't think Israel is uniquely evil in the history of the world. I think the United States has done that. Russia has done that. Every country has done that.
Yeah.
But what makes Israel different is that you're not allowed to say it somehow.
Yeah.
Because the idea is that, no, Israel lives by separate rules. No, that's not, I will never accept that. And just because you claim that God loves you more than everybody else doesn't mean I have to believe you. I don't believe you. I think God created every single person. And I think we're all subject to exactly the same standards, whether it's an African country or Asian country, Middle Eastern country, or my country. And when my country falls short, I'll admit it.
Yeah.
And I feel sorrow about it. But I'm not playing this game. Sorry.
You've been called an anti-Semite so many times recently, I lost count. And it's terrible because I know you're not an anti-Semite. And arguing that children should not be killed is not being an anti-Semite. Why do you do it? You know, I know you. You're in a good place in your life. Your children, your wife. By the way, did you have a grandkid yet? Or are you going to have a grandkid?
No, but I think they're working on it. I have three married children, so
hopefully.
You told me recently, I was telling you about Serena, our grandbaby, and you said, I'm so jealous of you. And I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah. Oof.
But you're doing all of these things now, and to a certain extent, I mean, you're right, stepping on a hornet's nest, and in many ways, getting the kind of attention a lot of people don't want. Why do you do it?
Because I can, because I'm privileged, because through no fault of my own or achievement of my own, I just like got old enough and insulated enough from the normal levers of control to say what I really think is true. That's it.
Yeah.
And because they pushed it too far, I think specifically the neocons in the war lobby in my country pushed the country toward its own destruction. This Iran war, the war with Russia, these are the things that will destroy the United States. And I live here and my family's been here, you know, for 350 years. And like, I don't want to see my country destroyed. So it's really, they push too hard. It's like, just back off. I'm happy to disagree with people. I get along with people I disagree with. I have a lot of friends I don't agree with. That's okay with me. But what you can't do is wreck everything. You're not allowed to do that. You didn't build it in the first place. That's how I feel about it. I'm not just, anyway, so they pushed too far. And the war with Iran is too far. The war with Russia is too far. And I'm just in this place where it's like, what are you going to do about it? Kill me? Okay, I'm not afraid of that. I'm a Christian. So I'm just going to keep talking. By the way, it's had no effect at all. I have no power. I have had no effect on recent history other than to whine about it. So I am not a powerful person. I'm an observer saying what I think is true, but I am as sincere as I can possibly be because I have the privilege of sincerity. I don't have any debt. And that's the last thing I'll say is the United States is a debtor nation. It owes more than it owns. It is, in some deep sense, bankrupt. And that is true of its population. People are in debt. They're encouraged to be in debt. I'm not in debt. I don't live in a huge way. I don't have an airplane. I flew coach last week. That's all fine with me. But what I don't have is debt. And when you don't owe banks or anybody else any money, you're weirdly a lot freer than you were before. And that's how I feel. I'm just going to tell the truth. And if you don't like it, I'm sorry. But this is what I think is true.
Yeah, I disagree with you. I think you are having an impact. And I think telling that truth and sharing it with people all over the world, people are watching this interview now all over the world, and they're listening to those words. And they think it is important for people to speak out because for too long, people have not spoken out. I mean, even the fact that you're here, we are on RT. This is a Russian television station. I can't tell you, Tuck, how many people talk to me all the time and say, Rick, I'm watching your stuff on the internet. You're doing a great job. It's fantastic. And then I'll say, would you come on the show? Well, I don't want to do that. If I was working at the BBC or Le Monde, they would be, you know, falling over themselves to be interviewed by me. What's the difference? What's the difference? I'm an American journalist who has an opportunity to speak, to work in a television network that I respect, who lets me. Here's my notes for this interview. Nothing was sent here by the Kremlin that I had to ask you, okay? I mean, this is just a conversation between two friends. But yet, I'm being told by some people, those same people you call the neocons, et cetera, you can't do that. You can't work for them. Why not? Right? So I'm saying thank you to you, because it's courageous.
Well, thank you, and I will, first world friends, obviously, but I mean, I do Israeli television. I would do North Korean television. I will speak to anybody who will hear me, and I will say what I really think is true. And by the way, I've often been wrong. I'm sure I'm wrong about things now, but I just want to say as often as I can what I believe is true, because that's the only power I have.
God bless you, man. I'm so, You've been so kind.
God bless you.
And so gracious with your time to give us this interview. And
we, oh, I love
it. You know, it's, and we'll talk again. And I'm sure we'll be sharing some notes as we go along the line here. And I'll be back in the States very soon. And maybe we'll be able to get together and have a cup of coffee. Thanks. Thanks, Tucker.
That'd be the best. Thank you, Rick.
Of course.
See you, man.
There you have it. Tucker Carlson, none other than a good hour conversation with someone who I'm sure, as you can tell, and I hope it wasn't a bias on my part. Maybe it is, and I'll just admit to it. I like him. I think there's a lot of people in this world who say things because they think it sounds good. There's a lot of people in this world who sloganeer. He doesn't. Every word that you just heard him express is something I know he believes because we've had conversations about these things in the past. And I know it's heartfelt. And I do believe that there are changes that need to be made. I'm an American. I love my country. And I would love to see our country serve its people better. And I think there's a small group of people who are keeping that from happening. And they're the ones getting in the way. And it's not the people. It's a certain group of people. Anyway, I could go on forever about this. As you know, this will be shared on social media. You will be able to see this on Spotify and on YouTube, where people will share it, I am sure. And many will criticize some of the things that we said, I am sure. And you'll be able to see much of this as well on X, where it'll be shared immediately. And I'm sure millions of people will see it there. And on BitChute, which I love because BitChute is the one social media platform that literally does not cancel people and does not make content disappear. Mine has many times. Most of all, thank you so much for letting us into your homes. We really appreciate it. I'm Rick Sanchez, and I'll see you next time.